I'm Tammy Faraday, and you're listening to Brave Journeys, the podcast about exceptional people who've navigated life's invariable challenges with courage, authenticity, grit, and grace. What happens when the love of your life, your husband, your best friend, the father of your three-week-old baby, who's gorgeous, funny, tall, exotic, and wonderfully attentive, the person you've basically banked your whole life on, turns out to be a psychopath? This was the agonising question facing my next guest, Jen Waite, as captured flawlessly in her international best-selling memoir, A Beautiful, Terrible Thing. In today's episode, Jen and I chat about her heartbreaking discoveries, every life-destroying lie, and what happens to a human being once they discover that the person they've built their entire life around never really existed.
That's probably when I really started to research like pathological liar and started to really dig into narcissism to try to figure out what was going on.
Jen's is a shocking tale of betrayal, brokenness, and rebuilding when the rug has been completely pulled out from under you. This is Jen's story. Welcome, Jen. It is so lovely to have you. I read your memoir, A Beautiful, Terrible Thing, and I literally couldn't put it down. And it's really funny to me because I'm a nonfiction freak and I've never been particularly drawn to thrillers per se. But your story, as heartbreaking as it is, certainly reads like one. It's a gripping, distressing, heart-stopping tale, and I read it in one sitting and I knew I had to have you on the show. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I know I'm so happy to be talking to you. And what you say about it reading like a thriller means a lot to me because I was almost writing it in real time and living my own thriller. So that came out on the page. So I appreciate you saying that.
It most definitely did. How did you and Marco, not his real name, how did the two of you meet?
We met in New York. I was 25. At the time, I was waitressing and he was a bartender at the same restaurant. And I had moved to New York a couple years prior. I'm from Maine originally. And the first few times that I interacted with him, it didn't seem like anything special to me. And then there was just this moment where it felt like he zeroed in on me, said my name, and I just had this full body feeling of like, this is the one, which I had never had before. And I know how, you know, cliche and like a fairy tale that sounds, but that is how it really felt to me. It felt like this moment in a movie when the two main characters meet for the first time.
And you write so viscerally about this magnetism that the two of you had. Can you describe the chemistry and the intoxication and the love bombing that expedited the intimacy between the two of you? What was it like?
I think when, at the time, of course, I didn't know that I was being love bombed, but when you are being love bombed, meaning you're just having this influx of attention and flattery and love being basically showered on you, to me, it felt like being home and like finally falling in love like I had always read about and seen in movies but had never experienced for myself. It was like, oh, this is how it's supposed to feel. I mean, it felt really, really, really good and really intense. But I think at the same time, in hindsight, but also in those moments, I did feel there was like a little voice in the back of my mind saying, wait a minute, can this be for real? Because it was happening so fast and it was so intense. And it really, every time we touched, it was like electric. Like I remember us touching knees under a table and feeling like lightning was shooting through my body. So it was almost too good to listen to that voice. I didn't want to hear that voice saying, wait a minute, it's been a week or two. How are you falling in love already?
What did you know about Marco and his life at this early stage of your relationship?
All I knew is that he was a single father. He seemed to be very hardworking. I knew that he had told all of our coworkers that he had just broken up with his girlfriend, a long-term relationship. And so he was kind of going through that process. The further along I got into our relationship, these things came out. Like, first they were broken up, and then it was that they were living together, but broken up. And then it was that they weren't technically broken up, but it was horrible. And he had tried to break up with her so many times. And so what happened is that he revealed these things to me little by little. And by the time, I mean, obviously saying all this at once, it's like, oh my God, red flag, red flag, red flag. But because it was like small doses and then mixed in with this really heady like infatuation and obsession and love, I always gave him the benefit of the doubt. And I was so in love at that point that honestly, there wasn't much that he could do, I think, to dissuade me.
And, you know, your life in New York was this passionate, mad love story about two people with ambition in spades who want to set the world on fire. So Marco's been working in the hospitality game for quite a while, and he's longing to start his own restaurant. And you're a model and an actor and sometimes waitress. Can you paint the scene for me of the life you were building before you fell pregnant and decided to get married?
Yeah, it was really exciting. I felt like I had kind of met my partner in crime and that we were going to conquer the world together. You know, he had pulled himself up by his bootstraps type story, where he came from his home country, came to the US on vacation with his family at 18, decided to just stay here and like live the American dream. He'd worked his way up from like busboy to server to bartender to head bartender. And I was finally starting to get some solid acting jobs. I got a really good agent and was going out on real auditions. So before we got married and got pregnant, it felt like we were living this real New York lifestyle of building our dreams together. And I felt that he was going to be my partner for life and that we had all the same goals and ambitions. And it was very exciting.
And it was, and that's how it read. I mean, it read like this magnificent, intoxicating love story about two people who found each other fairly randomly, which is often the case, and just connected and hitched their wagons to each other and were hoping for the absolute best. But the love was palpable. It was magical. And then you fall pregnant and you guys decide to get married. And you have this glorious wedding in Maine where your parents live. And Marco's family fly in from overseas to be with you. And if this isn't all magical enough, your amazing dad learns such an exceptional Spanish that he can deliver a not a dry eye left in the house kind of speech to his new in-laws. To read that was just so touching, and it was really, really beautiful. And it certainly made them feel incredibly welcome. And it was really, by all accounts, a day of immense love, excitement, and hope. What are your memories of the day, Jen?
Yeah, my memories are that, and they still are. I think because I have such closure from everything, I don't look back on it with anger or sadness or bitterness. I just look back and I'm like, wow, that was a really great day. And it's almost like seeing a movie. I don't even really connect it to it being myself. But when I look back, I feel like the happiness and the excitement. I mean, it was everyone says your wedding day is going to be the best day of your life. And that's how it felt to me. And just having both of our families come together was so special. Also, Marco and I had gotten the green card process started for him because we had technically gotten married at City Hall a year prior with just my parents and my sister as witnesses. And we didn't really tell anyone that. We told a few people, but basically we did that to get the green card process started so that by the time we got married in Maine with our big reception, we were jetting off in a few days to the south of France for a honeymoon. And it was amazing. And yeah, his parents flew from overseas and his sister and his sister's kids. It was really special and incredible.
A few short months later, your beautiful baby girl, Louisa or Lulu, also not her real name, is born. And the tectonic plates of your life begin to shift at this point. Jen, can you take me back to January 20, or D-Day, as you refer to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is when everything changed. And that's what I kind of refer to as the day when everything before that is the big before and everything after that is the big after. So it had been a few weeks since I'd given birth, and whether it was like actual postpartum anxiety or just anxiety, I was extremely anxious even before everything kind of crumbled. And so I had felt so overwhelmed those first few weeks. I hadn't even really, you know, taken a walk or checked my email. And I remember that Lulu had finally fallen asleep on me, and I opened up the computer that I shared with my husband, and it went straight to my husband's email. And I remember just scanning the subject lines before I X'd out of it, which of course my therapist has said to me, well, I wonder why you did that. And I don't know, maybe there was something in me that was suspicious or didn't feel like something was right. But if you had asked me at the time, I would have said, no, absolutely. Everything was perfect. But I scanned the subjects of the email, and you know, in Gmail, you can see the first line of the email. And one of them caught my eye because the subject line was apartment appointments or apartment viewings, something like that. And then the first line of the email was from Marco to this apartment broker saying, thank you for your time last week, but my girlfriend decided to go with another apartment. And that is when the bottom kind of fell out. And I had this really strange, like out of body experience, like an alternate reality, but it didn't really hit me. I remember laughing and just thinking in my head, why is he calling me his girlfriend when we've been married for a year? That doesn't make any sense. And almost thinking, you know, silly Marco, he must be just as sleep deprived and overwhelmed as I am. But then of course my brain kicked in and I was like, but I didn't see any apartments with him last week. And then I saw that he had forwarded the email to a name. And of course, you know, this made it even more confusing for me because I didn't recognize the name right away because it was a Croatian name. And so like nothing made sense. And I remember just staring. And of course, you know, Lulu is like on my lap, screaming, has woken up at that point, probably felt my pulse start to go insane. And the first thing I did was call him because I wanted to surprise him. I was like, okay, I'm going to be smart about this. I don't think anything's wrong, but just in case, I wanted to surprise him and just see what he said, get his reaction, because I knew that his voice would tell me everything. Because from my perspective, it's like, we're madly in love. We just got married, just went on a honeymoon, just had a baby. You know, there's no way, in hell that he actually has a girlfriend and is renting an apartment with her. That doesn't make any sense. So I called him and I think I just blurted something out like, what the hell were you doing looking at apartments with blah, blah. And he just laughed like the sweetest laugh. And it was such a genuine Marco reaction, like goofy reaction. And he was just like, oh my God, babe. Okay. He said you are going to laugh when you hear the explanation for this. And so he said, I am helping this employee of mine get an apartment. She's doesn't have papers. You know, I relate to that a lot. Like I almost feel like I was in her shoes 10 years ago and she's young, she's dumb. I mean, he said all the things that sounded so true, mm-hmm. And so realistic in the situation. She's so dumb. He kept saying stuff like that. I remember thinking in my head, okay, I can't just forgive him like this easily though, because this is one of those moments where I'm going to set my boundaries. So I said, I believe you, but you still need to come home and talk this through with me, because it's still extremely inappropriate that you would call a broker and refer to yourself as someone's boyfriend without discussing it with me first. And, you know, I thought I was being really tough, like the tough wife. And he said, okay, hung up. And he came home right away. And as soon as he stepped into our apartment, it was like, I thought we were going to just hash it out and everything was going to be great. But as soon as he stepped into our apartment, it was like a completely different person had entered the house. And I immediately just felt like this chill in my body, and like I didn't know who he was. It's really hard to explain, but all of his mannerisms were completely different, and there was nothing but behind his eyes, and it just felt like he was a zombie. And so I thought he was going to come in, you know, the opposite, like, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. And he came in, didn't say a word, and just slumped into the chair and said, all right, we can talk about that email thing later, but there's something way more serious that we need to talk about first. That is the fact that I have been really sick for months, and I didn't tell you because I didn't want to stress you out while you were pregnant, but now I think I need help. I need support from you. It was the biggest mindfuck because it was like whiplash. It was like emotional whiplash. And all of the anxiety and like stress of having a newborn, I just did not know what to think. My mind switched from being angry to being, holy shit, my husband looks like death, basically, warmed over. And I just thought, I have to help him.
And obviously, we haven't deep dived into how your life unravels after this point, but the manipulation of that, of displacing your legitimate concerns about his fidelity, his love for you, with claiming that he has this dire illness, and then you just jumping in and swooping in, as women invariably do, to want to care for this person and completely squash your own legitimate emotions, was very, very, very disturbing to read. I mean, he says he comes home and you want to have it out with him. You want to have this conversation with him, and you actually want to feel better. And he says, for around a year now, I haven't been happy. I lost all my feelings. I think there's something physically wrong with me, or I don't know. Like right now, I'm looking at you and I feel nothing. I feel numb. Now, just for the audience's benefit, let's just reiterate here, your baby is 3 weeks old. And your husband is unrecognizable, and you say so hauntingly, his eyes are dead. There is nothing there. There is nothing behind his eyes. What do those searing words do to you?
It was devastating. I mean, it was terrifying. I was in the most vulnerable position that I'd ever been in my life, and I'm not really a person who likes to be vulnerable anyway. So I think it was truly the only time in my life where I was really physically vulnerable. I mean, I was still recovering from childbirth. And to hear him say that he looked at me and felt nothing, it was just absolutely devastating. Tears were just like streaming down my face, but I wasn't full out crying because I was so confused at the same time. I was trying to figure things out because I just felt like this does not make any sense at all.
It's literally like a light switch.
Yes.
You go from having this incredibly loving, adoring, attentive man to someone who's saying, I feel nothing for you. And it just happens to be said to you at exactly the same moment that you uncover something.
I know it's difficult, Tam, to talk about it now without that hindsight perspective of being like, wow, that was so manipulative. And knowing everything that I know now, you know, about what I've researched about narcissistic personality disorder and psychopathy and gaslighting and manipulation and pathological lying, everything does make sense now. But in real life, I didn't know any of that.
Of course. Why would you?
I had never really understood the expression, like the rug gets pulled out from under you. I mean, that's what it felt like. I felt like the rug was pulled out from under me. My entire world had just collapsed, but it didn't make any sense. I could not figure it out. And I'm a logical person who needs to at least understand things. Like I could understand if we weren't happy or if we'd been fighting or, you know, something, but in my mind, from my perspective, that had not been the case. He was 1,000% loving to all of a sudden, you know, like his true persona came out. But at the time I was just like, okay, does he have a brain tumor? I mean, that was actually a thought that I had, that my mom had, that I think his mom had, that a lot of my friends had. We were really researching like brain tumor, cancer, what's going on.
We all do this. We cherry pick the information that we can actually absorb. And so you wanting to find other explanations when you'd been with a man for 5 years who was nothing but love on a stick makes perfect sense. And you were protective of him and you loved him. And when someone comes to you who is your whole world and they say to you, I am sick, something is terribly wrong with me, which may explain the fact that they seem devoid of feeling, you will go to the ends of the earth to fix them, to help them and to heal them. That's logical.
Exactly. Exactly. I wanted it to be something that could be fixed. And I totally grasped onto that because him having a girlfriend and, you know, and having another apartment with this person and living a double life was not something that could be fixed. And so I cherry picked, like you said, the information that my brain could at least accept. And I just clung to it.
And, you know, during that conversation that you had with Marco, he then says this, babe, we barely see each other anymore. I'm always working. We never do fun couple things anymore. You used to really put effort into your appearance, you know. I mean, I would look at you before an audition and think, God damn. Again, I'm going to reiterate here. Your baby is 3 weeks old. And Jen, when I read that, my blood went completely cold. Having worked on a domestic violence task force and having worked as a lawyer with women who'd been the victims of domestic abuse and coercive control, every single alarm bell in my body sounded and I wanted to scream at the page, unsafe, unsafe, warning, warning, get out of there.
Mm. Oh my gosh, it was the worst.
Oh, it was so disturbing to read that because I just thought, I'm a mother of 4 kids. I know what it is to be 3 weeks postpartum. You can barely get out of bed because the exhaustion is so consuming, let alone the anxiety, let alone the worry, let alone the fact that your husband was nowhere to be found because during this period he was working round the clock, well, so he said, and claiming that he didn't have a minute for paternity leave, a minute to be able to spend some time with you, a minute to help usher in this new family life with you. And I was desolate to read that for you. And then things really start to unravel. But all the while, you have a husband who denies everything. And he's fiercely maintaining all of his lies. He's gaslighting you and he's claiming to have this dreaded illness, which we've already established turns you from a woman who has legitimate terror and doubts to someone who goes in to want to be the caretaker and fix this guy. What goes through your mind when you discover that when Marco claims to be working around the clock, as we've just spoken about, which is what prompts you, totally understandably, to go to Maine and be with your parents for a bit of support and a bit of love that most new mothers need? You know, we need a community. We need a village to get through those first few difficult weeks, difficult months, difficult years, but that's a whole other story, right?
Yeah.
So you go to Maine. And he's claiming that he can't take a second off because he's literally working what seems like 24 hours a day. And then you find out that the time that he so-called was working 24/7, he was really with his mistress. Because as a new mother, Jen, I cannot fathom how you took that in.
I really wasn't able to take it in fully. I mean, I think that bit by bit, my brain processed it. Sometimes I understood it, like the cognitive dissonance thing. Sometimes I would understand what was going on, and sometimes it would be like back to square one where I just couldn't wrap my brain around it. And also, you know, what you were saying before with his kind of sudden critiquing of my appearance, it was like the opposite of our entire relationship. He had always been just over the top flattery about, you're so beautiful, blah, blah, blah. Like, you don't need any makeup. So when he started to say things like that, it was really shocking, but it was also in, you know, a time when I was 3 weeks postpartum and didn't look so great or feel so great. So there was a part of me that was all of a sudden massively insecure. Instead of feeling angry or feeling like, how dare you? I was like, oh, maybe that is true. You know, I haven't been keeping up my looks. And we haven't been doing stuff as a couple. And again, it was such a mindfuck that I was trying to take in all this information. And sometimes I think my brain would just glitch and not be able to handle it. But I remember that, you know, thanks to social media and everything being online now, I was growing more and more suspicious because I was on the one hand believing this whole I'm sick thing. I was clinging to that. But on the other hand, there's that like gut instinct that we all have that my stomach was telling me something is not right. And so I was pretending to believe the sick thing, but then whenever I could, I was like digging. And that's when I looked at, you know, we had joint everything, joint Grubhub, joint HBO, joint Apple accounts. And so I would have never thought to look at this just even a month earlier. But when I was in Maine, I looked at those dates and saw that he had been home ordering food, that he had been watching, you know, movies and having takeout for two. And my mind was completely blown. That's probably when I really started to research like pathological liar and started to really dig into narcissism to try to figure out what was going on. Because I'm, you know, maybe had lived a bit of a sheltered life where I hadn't come across, or I wasn't aware that I had come across someone who could lie so well. I mean, really lying like they're telling the truth and with details and with little relaxed gestures. And, you know, usually when someone's lying, you hope that you can tell that they're lying. And in TV, you can always kind of tell, you know, they look a little like fidgety or they're, you know, they won't look at you in the eye. But this was like next level. I mean, he was a better liar than most people were truth tellers. So that's when I really started to think, okay, I might be dealing with something more than just a guy who's like having a midlife crisis. Because he, even when I came to him with evidence that I was finding this like breadcrumb trail that he had left, he would just deny and just flat out say it wasn't true. And so I'm starting to think, wait, am I insane? Like I was really starting to doubt my own reality and my own instincts because he was saying it so convincingly and so forcefully and saying things like, Jen, if I ever even came close to cheating, I would break up before I would do that because you cannot have, you know, a relationship with no trust. And then something else he did, and, you know, I guess now I know this is called trickle truthing.
What's it called? Trickle truthing.
Trickle truthing. When they kind of tell you a little bit of the truth, it actually makes the lie seem more believable. Right. I remember him telling me, all right, I'm going to tell you something that I've never told you. You know, at the very beginning of our relationship, I was out at a bar and there was a mutual coworker that he mentioned that was a friend of both of ours. He said, she kissed me and I kissed her back for like 5 seconds and then I pushed her away. And, you know, just everything that's coming up now, I just feel like I have to tell you to just get everything out on the table. And I remember telling my mom after, oh my God, Marco told me this. And I think he's actually maybe too truthful. And, you know, like he's truthful to the point of almost being hurtful. And so, and she was totally agreeing. She was like, oh gosh, you know, he's too truthful. And of course now it's just really laughable to think of, you know, that being his confession when literally, you know, while I was in labor, he was on the phone with his mistress. And while I was 2 or 3 weeks out in Maine, he was having such passionate sex that he broke our bed. And that's another part in the book that even when I was discovering all these things, that he wasn't really working the whole time. You know, he was giving this girl rides because I was seeing like our Uber bills. It still took me months to just have this realization, oh, they broke our bed while I was in Maine and our crib was literally at the foot of the bed. And like the fact that it took me so long to put that together, I still months later didn't even believe that they had had sex. I was willing to accept that it was an emotional affair, but it still took me even longer to really be matter of fact about it and realize, okay, this is exactly what happened from the beginning.
But I have the benefit of seeing your beautiful face, and you have this sort of incredulity across it. Like, how could I have not known? How could I have not known? And I keep thinking, I know how intelligent you are, and I know what a beautiful writer you are. And I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And when you love someone, and when you believe in someone, and when you've invested in someone, and in your case, you invested your whole world into this guy. I mean, you financially underwrote him. You helped him establish a business. You helped him get a green card. You helped him have a reunion with his parents he hadn't seen in God knows how many years because he was illegal. There was no end to what you were prepared to do for the sake of this loving union. So to me, it's not astonishing, despite how smart you are, that you couldn't actually metabolize all this information, because it doesn't seem to accord with what your truth is. Mm. You know, it's really hard to assimilate that information when the day before you were madly, passionately in love. As you said, there were no red flags in the sense that you'd been fighting or you were sleeping in separate beds. None of that kind of existed. So it makes sense that that's exactly where you were at, and that it took a period of time for you to actually internalize that. I just think you're amazing you've survived it, but I certainly don't think for a second that you're silly or that you were naive. You were trusting. That makes you a beautiful person. That doesn't make you a stupid person.
Well, thank you. And to further what you were saying about, you know, I really poured so much of myself into the relationship. At the time, it just felt like being a supportive, madly in love partner. But now, again, in hindsight, it was like I was this unlimited narcissistic supply. And that's what I found out after going through this ordeal. I basically found out that I was this huge well of narcissistic supply. And these types of people are parasites who hop from host to host and suck out the life force of whoever they're with. And anyone who's been through this type of relationship will understand exactly what I'm saying.
It's haunting, but it's so accurate. You say, now I understand why sociopaths are dubbed human heroin. I've been shooting pure, unadulterated, psychopathic love into my bloodstream for 5 years. I'm coming down from a drug I didn't even know I was on, and the withdrawal has knocked me on my effing ass. And Marco wasn't a garden variety cheat. And that's not to suggest that someone on the receiving end of infidelity is in such an optimal position compared, but there was more to it. There was so much more to it. This wasn't a person that engaged in one-night stand and turned his life upside down or his family's life upside down, because it could do that too. This was someone who was systemically lying and feigning a reality that just did not exist. And you know what? An ordinary cheat, I would imagine, is the kind of person that if you confronted them with the truth, they relent and they either confess or they ultimately admit. It might not happen instantaneously, but it certainly does. Marco had no bar of this. He was not going to even afford you the decency to give you the truth, no matter what you'd gone through.
I read Martha Stout's Sociopath Next Door, and that was the whole book is about, you know, what does a sociopath look like, act like, and it's not all rapist murders, et cetera. But her biggest thing was, if you confront someone's bad behavior and they somehow manage to change the narrative to make you feel badly about yourself or sorry for them, then you probably are dealing with someone on the spectrum, because that's not normal human behavior. And using your empathy against you, because they don't have that. They don't have those feelings. And so you immediately want to help someone when, you know, oh, you did this and this wrong. And they're like, my grandmother just died. And suddenly you're, oh my God, I'm a terrible person if I keep yelling at you. Oh gosh. And that's literally what he would do in maybe a little more subtle way.
And you know what, I so related when you first met your therapist, not in terms of the content, but you talk rapidly and you try and outpour all that's gone on in record time because of this. You're in a really bad way, we should say. You're emotionally really devastated. And you sort of had this primal urgency to be fixed, to be healed, and to feel better. And I tried that once in my 20s. And it didn't go down so well. I remember frantically talking because the thought of surrendering to therapy in the first place was horrifying to me. And then the thought of it going on for a really long time was just something that was just beyond my comprehension. And so, you know, trying to be uber efficient, I remember going and thinking, this is the opportunity to bleed everything that's ever gone wrong in my entire life onto this person. I mean, looking back now, it was funny, but it wasn't funny at the time because all it achieved was this sense of complete overwhelm, and it gave me a grade A panic attack, and I literally couldn't cope with ripping the Band-Aid off quite that quickly. But you do see a therapist and you share with her what you were experiencing, but you were a bit circumspect with what you shared with her. And I thought reading that was possibly because you were still protective of Marco, but also you wanted there to be a plausible explanation why this horror was happening. So you didn't want to feed her a line basically or lead the witness and tell her that he's a psychopath. You wanted her to sort of come to her own conclusion, but you didn't want to give her too much ammunition to make that finding.
And also, I am not a therapist or a licensed clinician, so this is all my own, you know, diagnosis. But I do remember just, yeah, basically word vomiting and wanting to get it all out because I felt like if she knew everything, then she could give me the steps that I needed to take to heal and I would just follow them and it would be great. And I also wanted her to confirm basically what I had discovered or suspected. She was the person that I needed her to be at that time. I needed someone to basically hold my hand and say, yes, I believe that he might be on the sociopathy spectrum. And I very much advise you to go no contact as soon as possible. And it's funny because when I met with her after she read the book, she was like stunned at how I remembered our first session. It was completely different for her.
Right.
And so that's just another really fascinating look at your truth, you know, or your perspective.
Of course.
And so my perspective was just like, okay, she's the professional. I'm really, really, really messed up. I'm going to tell her everything. She's going to give me a diagnosis and then I can start to heal. She said that she doesn't even really remember like the first session. And for me, it was such a momentous aha moment of, yes, she said the word sociopath. Oh, thank God.
Because it would have been so validating. Yeah. I mean, it would have been horrifying. Let's not kid ourselves, but it would have been validating to hear that. Is it true that she said that in 10 years of practicing, that was one of the most extreme cases of pathology that she'd ever heard?
She did say that. I definitely remember her saying that. And also, there are parts of the story that I could not publish that were basically the worst parts of the story, that Penguin Random House's in-house attorney vetted it and said, you know, these are criminal allegations. And unless someone has actually been charged, you can say almost anything as long as it's true, but you can't make criminal allegations because, well, that's self-explanatory, unless the person has actually been charged and is in jail. So the very worst parts I couldn't put in the book. But I think for my therapist, hearing everything, it was very easy for her to at least, you know, tentatively say, this person sounds like he is on the spectrum for sure.
In what ways did Marco's gaslighting manifest? Can you give me some examples of some of the things that he said to you that made you doubt yourself, question your own sanity, question your own take on things?
I remember one really specific example, because a lot of it was so subtle and hazy that it's just like the whole thing was gaslighting. Basically, the whole big thing of saying, what are you talking about? I'm just sick is one big gaslighting tactic. But something really specific was when he had tagged me in a picture on Instagram. And this was a really big deal. Of course, it wouldn't have been. I didn't feel like I was that person a month prior, but suddenly being tagged by my husband on Instagram, I was, oh, thank God. So you know, he is showing that he loves me, or we're together, or whatever. And it was just a picture of my sunglasses, because we had been out to eat together and he had taken a picture of the table. It was good lighting. It looked cool. I don't know, but he tagged me in the picture. And I remember just being so thrilled about that, which is so sad. But at the time I was just like, oh, thank goodness, it's something, I'll take it. And I figured if he had a girlfriend, well, he probably wouldn't be tagging me in photos on Instagram currently. So I noticed just a few hours later that the tag was gone. And this is the type of thing where, by me calling him out on it, I really did sound crazy. And I knew it. And he just said, you sound completely insane. What are you talking about? I never tagged that picture in the first place. I really felt like I was having a little bit of a mental break, because I did convince myself that I had never seen the tag, or I was like trying to go back in my mind and really pinpoint it. Did I see the tag? Didn't I? They're basically negating your reality. And it, when it's someone that you love and trust, it's extremely harmful to your mental health.
Of course.
Yeah. And I really didn't know what was true and what was not true at that point. And so I said to him, at this point, it's over. It's just over. There's no trust left in our relationship. I'm sobbing this, you know, in the moment, but just I'm saying it like in a normal voice right now. Doesn't matter. It's over. We're getting a divorce, but just, I need to know for my own peace of mind. Please tell me, did you have sex, or were you physical with this woman? Because in my mind, that really mattered. And it's not logical. I can't really explain it now why that mattered so much, but I just...
What do you mean? Why does it not make sense?
Well,
of course you'd want to know.
Well, I guess I want to kind of be above that and say that it doesn't matter in a way, because it was over from the moment that he lied. But yeah, as a woman, I wanted to know if my husband had been sleeping with this other woman. And he looked at me and he just had these tears coming from his eyes. And he said, I know it's over. I know we're getting a divorce. What I say doesn't change anything, but I do want you to know for your own peace of mind, I never touched her. I never touched her. And I want you to know that, you know, even though our marriage is over, I just want you to know that. So that's another example of obviously extreme gaslighting and, you know, pathological lying. But it's like he couldn't admit wrongdoing. If he was going to exit the situation, he had to be the victim. The very biggest way that he changed the narrative was when I finally left, you know, New York with my parents and my baby. And he texted all of us at the same time and said, it's like, I'm ending my life, because I didn't ever touch that person. He kept saying, always called her that person. He would never say girl or woman. He would always say, I never touched that person, but I'm ending my life because you're leaving, and tell Lulu that I love her, and blah, blah, blah. And I just absolutely lost my mind and tried to go back and save him once again. And my mom stopped me and said, if he's serious, if he's going to hurt himself, then you can't do anything for him. You need to call 911. That's who can help him. And so I did. And the paramedics came. He had his head in the oven, which, again, not to downplay, but you can no longer end your life by putting your head in the oven. It's not physically possible anymore with the way that ovens work in America today. But anyway, he was involuntarily committed. And I found out later that his mistress had also broken up with him. And so rather than admitting that he had done something wrong, that was the extreme that he wanted to go to, you know, rather than just finally saying, okay, I'm in the wrong, he still found a way to make himself the victim. And I remember my sister saying, wow, it's really the Marco show. And she's just has these one-liners that kind of sum it up. And that is it. He wanted to make it so that he was the victim and that he would either get me back or get his mistress back, who had broken up with him because she heard him say, I love you, to me. You know, when he was pressed into a corner like that, he resorted to pretending to hurt himself rather than go the other way and hurt me, because that is something that was never, ever even on my mind. But since the memoir's publication, I have received so many emails from women and some men who have said that, you know, Marco reminds them so much. It is like there's a sociopath or narcissist handbook. And these people have said, you're so, so lucky that you got out when you did, because my ex went on to be physically abusive. And one woman even said, my ex went on to kill his next partner.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It was very chilling to get that email, because she said the exact behavior that Marco displayed. And even her friends and family said, well, you know, he might be a narcissist, but he's not violent. He's a coward when it comes down to it. And she said she knew. And then 20 years later, it took 20 years, but he eventually did kill his partner and he is in prison. So you don't know, because I think that those personality types are capable.
Look at the statistics of women who are living with domestic violence and coercive control.
Yeah, exactly.
I would like to think of myself as a fairly good judge of character, similar to you. And then I think back to a relationship with a very abusive man in my 20s, when I second-guessed myself constantly and was eternally gaslit and excused all of his sadistic behaviors. I was trying to think whether I chose to dwell on him being kind at the beginning. I don't even think he was that kind at the beginning, but there was something that was completely magnetic about him, and he was brilliant. And I always pedestalize someone's intellect, but cruel, cruel, cruel. And my best friend and I were talking about this really recently, and she reminded me, I didn't remember this, but that I was really just a shadow of a person at the time. I was frail in size, and I was even frailer in emotional strength, and I was completely devoid of self-worth at this stage. And, you know, it is quite remarkable. We've spoken about cognitive dissonance, and we've spoken about the things that we park and we just don't sort of focus on, because we're trying to conjure up this version of a person and those things just don't really make sense, the dark underbelly of their conduct. But it is quite remarkable how the brain rationalizes away the behaviors of the psychopath. And you found yourself compulsively checking through Marco's various social media profiles, and your therapist really cleverly asks you when you log in whether you kind of get a rush of nervous adrenaline followed by almost like a come down. And you agree that that's exactly what it feels like. And then she reflects back that this obsessive, compulsive, and let me just add here, completely understandable behavior is fairly common when wading through the aftermath of trauma. And it made me think about something else, because someone very dear to me shared that when their spouse cheated on them, and it was in a time that predated social media, they found themselves completely out of character, ringing their spouse's colleagues and associates and friends, anybody who knew this person, trying desperately to get some clarity and to try to pull these disparate pieces together just to make some sense of their life, because they'd lost all their bearings. Everything that made sense on a Monday doesn't make sense on a Tuesday. If your whole life has been pulled out from under you, as you said so poignantly, you know, when the rug is pulled out to that extent and you're completely sideswiped, you want to make sense of the horror. So I want to know, when you were looking up his social media posts, what were you looking for? What were you hoping to find? And maybe more importantly, what were you hoping to feel, Jen?
I think that I was trying to piece it together, like you said, and figure it out in a way that would make sense for my brain to process it. I am someone who needs to understand something in order to process it. I feel like I can't just move on. And so for better or worse, that was part of my recovery process, was being obsessive compulsive with, you know, checking social media, just trying to piece together what exactly had happened. It was like I wanted to know all the dirty details. Every scrap of information, I felt like I was getting closer to understanding it and getting closer to being able to find the truth for myself. I find it less scary in a way if I can understand something rather than just saying, oh, well, that's too bad that that happened to me. I hope it doesn't happen again. But I think that that was maybe just a gateway into finally turning inward, because that's much, much scarier. And that's the work that I did with my therapist. And that is the kind of the healthier outlets that, you know, she was probably hinting at, that eventually I had to, rather than you know, oh my God, did he like her picture? Did he comment on her post? Are they still together? What's happening? Because also remember, he wouldn't ever actually admit to me that they did have an affair and that they were together. So it was like, because I was being lied to just so blatantly, I guess I felt that I wanted to prove him wrong or something, or I don't know. I would say to anyone else in the same situation, turn inward rather than trying to make sense out of that person's behavior, because you're not going to get closure from them. But again, it's much easier said than done, because I had to go through that process myself of being very obsessive and checking everything and finding out all the details. And before I could really go and like break myself down and like rebuild my self-worth and my boundaries, I didn't even know what boundaries were. I hadn't done any of that work before. And so that was the hardest part, but that was the part that ultimately led me to heal and to get closure, was looking at not how I was to victim blame, but to look at, you know, why did I miss certain red flags? Why was I attracted to that type of person? Why did I filter out all of his bad qualities and only see the good qualities? Why did I want to be put on a pedestal? Like, what was going on in my own inner life? And so doing that work was by far the scariest work to do, but it was life-changing. It completely changed how I view myself and how I view the world now.
There's this incredible scene where you're back living with your parents, who are really phenomenal people, by the way. They really are just
very lucky.
Such an incredible support system. And they didn't kid to you when they couldn't kid to you, but they held you tight, and you've credited them with saving your life and your daughter's life. But there's this incredible scene where you're back living with your parents and you've pushed yourself to go for a run. And you cover the ground where your wedding vows took place and you run up the stairs Rocky style. Well, that's just how I saw it in my mind's eye. And you climb these stairs that you had climbed on your wedding day, and you say, "This time I'm alone. And when I reach the spot where my father kissed my cheek and gave me to Marco, I finally stop. I remember how filled with love I was on that day. I remember looking at the man across from me and knowing that he would make me happy forever. And now it's time to let go of that man. Because that man never existed. There is no old Marco and new Marco. Marco was an illusion, the best magic trick I've ever seen." That is so powerful. You know, I think we're acculturated actually to be self-deprecating. So if someone doesn't love us from one minute to the next, we assume that we've done something wrong, or that there's been an intervening factor that has taken their love away or their affection away. But what you register and recognize in that moment was there wasn't a former version of this man. He was actually a fiction. He never really existed. And that must be so horrible to acknowledge, but also, I hope in time, a little bit cathartic, that you weren't a fool and you weren't an idiot. By a long stretch, you were just somebody who was at a time in your life where you were receptive to being loved and you were receptive to giving your all. And unfortunately, you got the short straw and you just ended up with someone who was really damaged and very ill. I mean, it's a disorder. That's not to throw inordinate empathy on him. It's just to suggest that this is a person who lives with some kind of psychiatric illness, because this behavior is completely not normal. It's not normal.
Narcissistic personality disorder and psychopathy are a personality disorder, but it's not considered a mental illness. That's just to kind of point out that I think a lot of people with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, they're not lumped in with a psychopath or a sociopath. So it's not considered a mental illness. It's sad and it's bittersweet, but it was also so freeing to finally be able to wrap my mind around the fact that, yeah, he was an illusion. And to be able to see him in a clinical sense, and that's how I see him now, I really don't feel sad or happy or mad or angry. Like, I don't feel anything when I think of him. I just see him from a very like bird's eye perspective of, this person lacks empathy. They don't respond to the world like I do. So it was really freeing and cathartic to have that realization.
Do you have any contact with Marco at this stage?
None. We have not had any contact for at least 5 years.
And I presume that means your daughter doesn't have any contact with him.
No, and we have talked, you know, she's six, so this is her world and she doesn't question it, but she has asked a couple times, what's my father's name or blah, blah. And I try to just say, you know, his name is blank and this is a picture of him if you're interested. And she looked at the picture and she has just didn't care at all. And then I said, you know, he wasn't really able to parent in the same way that I am able to, and that your Mimi's able to, and that your granddad's able to. He couldn't really do it that well. And so we decided that I should do it because I'm able to do it really well.
Jen, you come from a really remarkable family that we've spoken about. You know, they're loyal Team Jen all the way kind of family. How do you think you were as susceptible as you were and blindsided by Marco? Because I always think that family of origin stuff is just so profound, but you really did seem to come from functionality. So mm-hmm. I wanted to know why you may have been as susceptible to this sort of overwhelm of love or seeming love.
It does show that everyone is susceptible, and it's not necessarily about how you were raised or having this traumatic background, particularly. I mean, I have a very strong, I guess, fantasy life, if you want to call it that. And I am very like a romantic person and I wanted to live a fairy tale. You know, I'm a writer and that's now what I do for a living. I get to put those fantasies onto the page and not try to live them out in real life. But I think that that's was my, I guess, vulnerability, is that I wanted that big firework love story. And I just thought, this is how it's portrayed in movies and in books and in TV. There's a lot of triangulation, you know, there's a lot of cheating, and then they get back together and it's even better than ever, and anger and fighting and breaking up and making up. And so I just thought, this is what it is. This is what real, true, passionate love is. Now I realize that I was just trying to live a fairy tale that, for very good reason, they're fairy tales and they're not what is needed in a healthy relationship.
Based on that, how do you approach relationships differently now? What have been probably your greatest learnings?
I am in a relationship now and have been in for about a year and a half. And it's really my first serious relationship. I took a very long time to do so much of that self-work, to build myself up and to be able to very quickly shut down any kind of bad behavior, I would say. I would say that I think and I hope that I actually repel people like that now. And I think that's because I have a very strong sense of self-worth and very strong boundaries now. And I take things very slowly and I have my eyes wide open. And if things even feel a little bit strange in my stomach or my instincts, I really listen to them now. And it's funny how quickly people like that will kind of bugger off when you actually have boundaries and they don't have a good explanation for, you know, what they're doing or what they're saying.
Wasn't it your grandmother who says so beautifully, I loved it, your stomach always knows the truth? And it does.
Exactly. So, you know, it might not be as exciting or as romantic to not be on this like emotional roller coaster of a relationship, but it's so much more fulfilling and satisfying to really be in this grounded, healthy relationship.
And I love that you are. What will you tell your precious little girl when she's old enough to know what you went through at the hands of her father?
I will tell her the truth. She's so smart and intuitive, and I trust her, you know, intelligence and perception. And so I don't want to sweep anything under the rug or hide anything from her. I think that that's where a lot of trauma can stem from repressing things like that. And so, you know, so far, obviously, I've told her in a very, I guess, child or age appropriate way. When she is old enough to read the book, obviously, I can't stop her from reading the book. And, you know, to be honest, when I wrote the book, she was a newborn. So I wasn't in that frame of mind of thinking, what is she going to think? I really wasn't. It was like almost an out-of-body experience when I wrote it. So I think I'm just open and hopefully realistic to the fact that she could go any which way. She could be really upset at me. She could she could just say, oh, I'm so glad to know everything and have all these tools to work with. But I guess I'm going to tell her the truth and trust in her intelligence. And I mean, we're very close. And I hope that by me giving her these tools, she can just form her own story. And I will say, this is my story. I wrote my story. Your story might be different. And if you want to pursue a relationship with your biological father, I like by no means will stand in your way, but I do want you to know this truth and, you know, have these tools and hopefully be like a type of guide for her. But yeah, it's so different from how I was raised, because as wonderful as my parents are, and I've said many times, they really did save us. We didn't really talk about things like that. We more swept things under the rug, and I don't want to do that with Louisa.
Jen, you are a powerhouse. You're amazing. You are just amazing. And I see the joy on your face. And I can promise you, I wasn't there with you when you wrote the book, but you would have been in a very, very different state to the beautiful woman I see now, who really is full of confidence and grounded in your self-worth. And it's just beautiful to see. And like your one-time makeup artist who'd lived through a similar experience said to you, when you come out on the other side of this, the amount of power you walk away with is going to blow your effing mind. Well, it's surely blown mine, and I hazard a guess that our Brave Journeys family will feel the same way and draw incredible strength from your courage. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been amazing.
Thank you so much, Tam, for having me on. I absolutely loved chatting with you.
Thanks so much for listening today. The brave journey of my next guest is equally compelling, and I'm sure you won't want to miss it. Please join me by subscribing to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. Oh, and if you love the show, please don't forget to rate it and leave a review. Brave Journeys was created, hosted, and executive produced by me, Tam Faraday. But I couldn't do this without my wonderful team, including my audio editor, Zoltan Fecho, and a very special thank you to George Weinberg. Ask me any questions or let's chat about the episode on Instagram at Tam Faraday. That's TamFaraday. I'm Tam Faraday and I'll see you on TammyFaraday.com. That's Tammy with an I. See you next week.